ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
It is a truth universally acknowledged that on one's 250th birthday, there should be a celebration. I'm Claire Nichols, and on The Book Show, we're raising our teacups to Jane Austen.
Why Austen? What is it about her?
Authors Colm Tobin, Karen Joy Fowler, and more will explore why, in 2025, the Austen effect is bigger than ever.
That's quite incredible.
Search for The Book Show and look for Dear Jane wherever you get your podcasts, or hear it now on the ABC Listen app.
Hello, welcome to The Music Show on ABC Radio National. I'm Andrew Ford. We have a literary edition of The Music Show today. Later, we're going to hear about the musical world of Jane Austen in celebration of the 250th anniversary of her birth. And we'll also remember Guy Gauss, the Western Australian musician who's died at the age of 56. We'll hear some of a conversation I had with Guy and his partner Gina Williams about their work creating and advocating for music in Noongar language. First, though, the culmination of a month-long celebration of Australian words and music that we've been doing here on The Music Show in partnership with Red Room Poetry. Back in August, which is Poetry Month, the call went out for new Australian poems that had the potential to be turned into song lyrics, and the winning pair would be set to music by two excellent Australian artists, Dobby and Leah Senior. Well, today we have our winners. We're going to hear the two winning poems read by the poets themselves, and then we'll hear what Dobby and Leah have done with them. With me are David Stavanger and Nicole Smead from Red Room Poetry, who, along with my estimable producers, shortlisted the poems submitted. Hello, David. Hello, Nicole.
Hello.
Hi, Andy. Good to be here. Good to have some songs and poems out of this.
Yeah. Well, how many entries were there? Tell me.
We had over 1,000 in the end, which is a great reflection of the music show and ABC's listenership, but also the hunger out there for people to write poetry and find new homes for their work.
Yeah, or it could mean that our listeners have too much time on their hands.
At least they're using it in productive ways.
That's yeah. True. And what kind of poems were they, Nicole?
Oh, look, they really varied. We had sheep poems. We had poems about love, a lot of love poems, actually.
A lot of
broken hearts out there, which is, you know, very sad. I'm sorry, everyone. And they came from all over, like a very wide breadth.
Do you think that the poets had in mind the fact that these might be put to music? I mean, were they kind of leaning towards song lyrics rather than, you know, haiku, say?
Yeah, there were a lot of entries that had put thought into the way that the poem was structured, and they even said, this is the verse, this is the chorus. Mm. There was a lot of repetition in some of the poems as well. So as you were reading them, you could very much hear them as a song lyric. And then there were others that were more like a haiku or just a short few stanzas.
Yeah, so it needed a fair bit of repetition to make those work as songs, but not impossible. Who were the poets, David, apart from being music show listeners?
A really wide range of poets, a lot of voices we'd never heard of before, which is fantastic with any kind of literature-based competition, and exciting for us to see new lines from new people. But also, we got entries from poets and writers we knew well, very established writers putting their work in as well, which goes to show the kind of love within the poetry community for song and in lyrics as an extension of the form.
Well, we're going to hear one of the winning poems now. The first winning poet is Kate Kennedy, who some of our listeners might know as a novelist and award-winning short story writer. And the poem's called Reed and Oak. David, briefly, why this poem?
It's an interesting poem to being chosen, and I didn't even pick it as a Kate Kennedy poem when I first read it, but I think it's got a narrative arc, it's got a distinct bridge, and it's told from the point of view of a mother speaking to a daughter in relation to both of their relationships with nature and trees and the wind. And I think there's a lot to work with there in terms of song.
Well, this is the one that Dobby put to music, and we will hear from Dobby in a moment after Kate has read us the poem.
I asked my child beneath a tree, which one would you rather be? A small, slim reed or a strong oak tree? Would you be the tree, if the wind blows, that stands firm on the ground on which it grows, but maybe falls and maybe fails if that wind turns out to be a gale? Or would you be the soft green reed that's prepared to give and prepared to bend and survives that gale to stand again? She said, no, neither one of those. I want to be the wind. I want to be the wind. Let them go. Like a kite on a string in your hand, like a castle you've built in the sand, like a river finding its way down to the sea, it's you that will bend as they shake free. They will only return to this same ground to show you all the things they have found. Even as you're holding them, you know, you will let them go. And this child, who no one on earth loves more than me, who doesn't want to be a bending reed or a mighty tree, is gathering her sureness like a poem, is finding her own way home. Oh, my heart's true, clean north. My girl who wants to shake the branches of the tree, let me open this small window and set you free. Be the wind that wakes and heartens me. Come back one day and blow through me. Blow through me.
Thank you very much, Kate. That was Kate Kennedy reading her poem, Reed and Oak, one of the winners in our competition, Middle of the Air, that was put to music by Dobby. And we don't just have Kate, we have Dobby too. Hi, welcome back to the music show, Ryan.
Hi, thank you so much for having me. It's great to be back.
Kate, maybe I could start with you because you have heard what Dobby has done with your poem, and now that I've heard both you read it and Dobby's version, it seems like an obvious thing to do with it. But I wonder whether you were taken by surprise. I mean, for a start, you probably didn't realise you were going to get a rapper.
That's exactly right. I didn't think that. I looked at the poem and I thought, yeah, this one could be lyrics. It has a sort of a, what I would have called a kind of a space for a bridge in it, where it takes that sort of turn in the middle. And I was thinking, oh, I can imagine this being, you know, quite a melodic sort of song. Yes, I'll try with this one. And of course, when it was successful and I heard it was going to be Dobby, I was thinking, wow, that is a juxtaposition I am really interested in getting a chance to hear, because it's going to subvert my expectations altogether.
Before I come to Dobby and ask him, the poem itself, when you were writing it, how aware were you of the possibility of a musical outcome, or was it simply a poem you were writing?
It was simply a poem that I was writing, but I sort of find that once you start writing rhymes or alliteration into a poem, you're looking at very similar things, I think, that you are in a piece of music. It's a kind of a pattern of repetition and variation, and it's sort of got rhythms in it and stuff. And so you're looking for those sorts of beats that sort of occur in speech or that naturally occur in sort of slightly stylized speech. And so I think it does fall naturally into sort of stanzas. So it does sort of have a closer relationship, I think, to music than it does to, say, longer narrative prose. I think there's a very strong link between poetry and music.
Yeah. Dobby, you were given a few poems to choose from. What drew you to this particular one by Kate?
All of the entries for this competition were just so different, and they all had, like you're saying, Kate, this innate rhythm behind it, a particular tempo, all sorts of things that, you know, myself as not only a musician, but as a rapper and hip-hop producer, I was kind of looking for or seeing what resonated with me. And Kate's poem was actually the opposite of what I thought I would select in terms of initially finding something with a lot of lyrics, with a lot of, you know, fast-paced, rapid sort of rap prose, but it wasn't that. It actually was actually finding the wind and the breath between the words. And so I felt really drawn to it, not to mention how beautiful the story is in your poem, Kate. I was really super touched by it, actually. And, you know, I thought to myself, this is the one that really resonates with me the most. And I ended up sort of creating a bit of a fast-paced backing with a momentum that was more like a bit of like a dance track, but reflective, and letting the poem do the work and take its time, kind of like, you know, a slow breath of wind. Yeah.
And did it come to you quickly? I mean, as you were reading the words, did you start to get musical ideas almost immediately?
Yeah, there were some chords that just jumped out straight away. And those chords are the chords that I ended up with. But it was a fun process because for me, I just ended up repeating, just speaking the poem aloud. And exactly like you're saying, Kate, like just listening to what the natural rhythms of those words were. And I hope that I sort of honored the way that the poem is to be spoken aloud, rather than sort of fitting, you know, a circle in a square hole, I guess, creating a world around it. And that was the chords at first, and then the beat came with it. And then I realized, oh, this is kind of like a dance track.
You know? Is that how you normally work?
There's a lot of similar processes with what I did with your poem, Kate, and how I approached, say, a song like Dipi Yuan Pachilinya, which started with found sound, the recorded sound of the Pied Butcher Bird, or even like working music to be a backing behind Ani Josie Bino in my album Waranga River Story, or interviews and looking at how the rhythm of the words kind of dictate the tempo, the pace, even the chords. So it was a lot of that. And so I felt very comfortable, actually, not one part where I feel it was, you know, not really jiving with me personally. I really enjoyed the process.
And I like the fact that at the end, the dance takes over, you know, that the voice drops away and we're left with the backing track. It's no longer a backing track.
Yeah, you know, give it some space to breathe. And it is that conversation. And that's what I really wanted, that conversation between the poem and the music. And where does the poem shine, and when does the music shine, and how it backs it and supports it. I kind of started to repeat those final lines just to sort of bring that story back home. Yeah.
So Kate, what did you think when you listened to it for the first time? Did you feel as though your poem had been transformed, or did you feel as though perhaps Dobby had sort of seen into you?
You know what? I did feel like Dobby had seen into me, because the poem is a parent talking to a child, and this feeling of, I have to get out of your way. I have to kind of let you go. And I kind of thought, when I began to listen to it, and I was thinking, oh, yes, I love how reflective this is and almost how melancholy this is. But then Dobby did something fantastic where that turn takes place, where that kind of, you know, it's like a vulture, where suddenly it says, let them go. You know, the poem takes off in a different direction. And it's like a moment of realization for the person talking, for the person narrating. Mm. And there's a beautiful change in tempo. And it becomes this other, more celebratory letting go. And then there's this kind of natural elements of tide and wind and breath and the wind in trees and so on. And I just thought, he turned it into something else. And his voice also made something very beautiful and vital happen. It wasn't like an older person talking regretfully about giving away sort of childhood or something. It was actually this beautiful, positive energy and vitality of the beautiful, almost celebratory nature of a parent seeing what their child is becoming and hoping that they're going to be the wind that can sort of help push them along so they can be their own force in the world. I just thought it was beautiful.
That is so beautiful.
And the transformation that's in the poem that you write about takes place in the music now.
That's exactly right.
Yeah, no, I'm just sitting here just really resonating with what you've said, Kate. I think this is a process that every parent goes through in saying goodbye and letting their child sort of take flight. And, you know, me not being a parent, I'm sort of speaking from my experience as the child, as the son, I guess just like being curious about what that process is going to be like for me when I become a parent. And there's this beautiful exchange there. And I really loved, you know, hearing what you've said about what that was like for you and how that sort of comes out in the poem. I hope that it sort of feels the same way through the music.
Well, I think we shouldn't tease our listeners any longer because they're going to want to hear what we've been talking about, the musical transformation of Kate's poem. So thank you, Kate. Thank you, Dobby. And now let's hear your version, Dobby, of Reed and Oak.
I asked my child beneath the tree, which one would you rather be? A small slim reed or a strong oak tree? And would you be the tree if the wind blows that stands firm on the ground on which it grows, but maybe falls and maybe fails if that wind turns out to be a gale? Or would you be the soft green reed that's prepared to give and prepared to bend and survives that gale to stand again? She said, no, neither one of those. I want to be the wind. I want to be the wind. Let them go, like a kite on a string in your hand, like a castle you've built in the sand, like a river finding its way down to the sea. It's you that will bend as they shake free. And they will only return to this same ground to show you all the things that they have found. Even as you're holding them, you know, you will let them go. And this child, who no one on earth loves more than me, who doesn't want to be a bending reed or a mighty tree, is gathering her sureness like a poem, is finding her own way home. Oh, my heart's true clean north. My girl who wants to shake the branches of the tree, let me open this small window and set you free. The winds that wakes and heartens me, and come back one day and blow through me. Come back one day and blow through me. This small window and set you free. Be the wind that wakes and heartens me. Come back one day and blow through me. Blow through me.
Well, that's Dobby's version of Kate Kennedy's award-winning poem, Reed and Oak. And on today's music show, we're talking about words and music on the occasion of announcing the winners of the Middle of the Air competition, which we began in the middle of the year. And my guests, apart from the poets and the musicians, are from Red Room Poetry, David Stavanger and Nicole Smead. Nicole, what's your reaction to listening to that?
Oh, I love it. And it is just so beautifully Dobby. He has this really wonderful way of feeling the kind of the truth of something, the kernel of something, and being able to turn it into a beautiful sonic journey, which I think he's done so beautifully for this piece. It's a sonic poem to me, you know, his beautiful spoken word over the top. But if you listen to the soundscape he's created underneath, the poem lives within that. And there's so much heart and so much joy and freedom in the piece. It's just beautiful.
I love the way that his voice takes over, really, doesn't it? I mean, the words suit his voice, or his voice suits the words. I'm not sure which way around.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. And I think that's part of his, you know, his skill and his talent is to really kind of be empathetic and really feel into what is at the heart of the poem.
And David, I suppose one of the other things that is so pleasing about that version is that it's hard to imagine that Kate and Dobby's paths would have crossed had it not been for this competition.
It is hard to think that, but and yet now I'm totally not surprised. And that's what's great when you bring different genres together to intersect. And Dobby's really able to inhabit the words that still kept them with a resonance to what Kate had intended, but brought his own sort of voice and tenderness to the work as well. So it kind of ends up being their voice in that track for me, which is incredible.
Well, we should move on, and because we've got another poem and another song to hear, and it's Leah Senior's turn now to create a song from the other award-winning poem. This poem is called The Arbor, and it's the work of the poet and teacher Giles Watson, and we're going to talk to them both in a moment, and we'll hear what Leah has done with this poem. But first, we've got Giles reading the poem for us. He recorded this for us on location in his garden in Albany in Western Australia.
The Arbor. Look up through the slant of sun, the lit side of the leaf, whose weight gives curve to branches, which is the arc of life, and dots where flowers went to seed are lightless interpunctions, darkening the ray of sun when wind sways all to action. So here is everything you are before you go to ground, a twig, a crack, in firmament, as substance glints to sound.
Well, that was the voice of the poet Giles Watson in his garden in Albany, and we heard the wildlife as well. Thank you very much indeed, Giles, and thanks to the West Australian Magpies.
Thank you, Andy. I thank the magpies every morning.
It's very interesting hearing you read that. We're joined, as I said, by Leah Senior. Leah, welcome back to the Music Show.
Thank you, Andy.
Let's talk about the poem before we talk about the song, shall we? Because unlike the other finalist, this is a poem which looks like a poem. It's a poem on the page. And it seems to me, I don't know what you think about this, Giles, but that when you hear it, even when you hear it read as beautifully as you just did then, you miss things that you would get if you were looking at it.
Yes. And that is a virtue of having it also turned into a song in a way, because when you've got a poem on a page, you continually look back at that poem if it's a good one. If you've got a song and you love the sound of it, then you continually replay it. And I suppose, especially with that kind of a lyric where the meanings are a little bit slippery, it really helps to have that kind of repetition, and different ideas come to the listener at different times when they're in different moods as well. There's something about that lyric style that lends itself to a song in the style that Leah has turned it into, I think, as well. It's very introspective, and that kind of that beautiful folky style suits it.
Reading the poem on the page didn't put that sound in my head. So I was very, not surprised, but sort of delighted by it when I heard it. Leah, could you tell us about the process of turning that poem into music?
I started off in quite a different place. I was going to do something really kind of more freaky, less folky, and I went down that path, and then that didn't work. It just felt like a poem set to music, and I felt that I wanted to make it a song. So I just came up with that twirly little guitar ostinato and just found that it was really singable. Like, it was very easy to let the melody fall where it wanted to fall. It was pretty effortless once I had the guitar idea.
Yes, and a word about rhythm, because we hear the rhythm and we don't necessarily see it on the page. You must have read it to yourself a few times to get a sense of that.
That was one of the things that drew me to the poem, was the strength of rhythm. Like, the inherent rhythm made it really easy to convert to a song. I think what I found really interesting about the process was, you know, I was given maybe 30 poems to look through, and I would just sit there and try and sing them all a little bit and test them out. And I was quite surprised by how restrictive the song form actually is, and how this poem felt like it lent itself quite well, because you could hear it in your reading. It has a really beautiful, strong rhythm to it.
Yes, it does. Giles, can I come back to you? Because listening to you doing that reading, I mean, one thing that I wondered about was whether you were in the spot that the poem was about. I mean, it's called the arbor. Is that the arbor that you were sitting in?
Yes, it's a place where we sit regularly in the mornings underneath the tree outside the house. And yeah, it's just a very special place where the birds seem to be used to having us around. And so they come very close as well. And yeah, I've recorded other poems there at times as well, voice recordings. It's a place that inspires me. And there was a particular kind of, I'll use the phrase, there was a particular slant of light that morning when I wrote the poem, with the sun coming through the leaves. And there's a poem by Emily Dickinson, who is an American poet who I've been in kind of long dialogue with, I guess that's the right word, for a number of years. And she has a poem called There Is a Certain Slant of Light. She's actually kind of oppressed by that slant of light in the poem, whereas this one was more one of those moments of illumination where the things in life come together no matter how difficult life is.
Yes. Oh, that's interesting. So you're inspired by Emily Dickinson formally rather than in terms of mood, because when you say she was oppressed by the slant of light, I mean, she was oppressed by most things in life, wasn't she? So, yours is a lovely optimistic piece of writing.
Yeah, it is. I suppose it's optimism tinged with a certain melancholy. And again, like in some of her poems, like her most famous thing, Hope is the Thing with Feathers, you know, that is a beautiful, uplifting poem in many ways, but then the bird is flying through a storm and is being blasted by it. And yeah, and I suppose it's a little bit similar with mine, that there is an undercurrent of melancholy that grows out of my own condition. I have fibromyalgia, and so I kind of see the world sometimes through the haze of that. The beauty of the natural world is a thing that doesn't heal me, but it certainly sustains me and gives me a reason to persevere. So I don't think that's worked into the poem. And in terms of its rhythms too, Emily Dickinson uses dashes to suggest possible interruptions in rhythm, sometimes to build in little ambiguities or to suggest a moment where her mind has gone off on a different track. It's almost like she's using a nib pen and rests the nib against the page and you get the dash while she's thinking. And there are a few of those in this poem as well, which leave it all the more open, I think, to an interpreter, whether they're sitting and reading it or whether they're setting it to music.
Maybe it makes sense. I think we're both lovers of nature poetry, and I've had a song that was inspired by an Emily Dickinson poem as well. So I think that in some ways we must be on the same wavelength, and that's also why the poem spoke to me. So it's nice that it feels like, a two-way street.
And because we're about to hear it, is there anything that surprised you, Giles, about Lear's approach to your words?
I'm not sure if I am surprised or delighted, actually. I'm delighted by the way the piano takes up the train of thought of wind sways all to action. It's as if the song takes flight with the wind and catches the moment when the idea of writing the poem came to me. And earlier in the song, I also love the gentle shift of rhythm in the guitars at Arc of Life. This really beautifully captures the effect of shifting wind on the hanging leaves of the peppermint trees. And also, I think close to the end, the little drum beats give me the feeling that the arc of life is on an upward curve as the song ends. It's putting an image in my mind, which isn't in the poem, but might easily have been, of fallen leaves being lifted once more into the sunlight by the wind. So there are lots and lots of surprises, but they're gentle ones that are all about the way Leah has set the ideas in the poem, so that they can be carried further by the music.
Well, we should listen to it. We've heard Giles Watson reading his poem, The Arbor, and now we can hear Leah Senior's song, The Arbor. Leah, Giles, thank you very much indeed.
Thank you.
Thank you.
That's Leah Senior's song, The Arbor, to award-winning words from Giles Watson. That's the second winner in our Middle of the Air competition. You're listening to The Music Show on ABC Radio National. I'm Andrew Ford, and I'm with David Stavanger and Nicole Smead, who are from Red Room Poetry and whose idea this competition was. David, maybe your reaction to what Leah has done with Giles's words.
Kind of speechless hearing it again, you know, when you hear a track and it just keeps growing on you or kind of revealing itself on each listen. I mean, I was already a massive Leah Senior fan and knew what a deep love she had of poetry. And I think that really shows through in her response to this and also in choosing a very spare, short poem. It's only a couple of stanzas, which gave, with the music, a lot of possibility, which she's really explored about the unsaid in poems. Not everything in a poem is verbal. So there's almost a conversation happening for me back and forth there. And I also love that you have these two artists, Leah in regional Victoria, Giles on the coast, slightly regional in WA, that have sort of come together unknowingly through this.
Yes, that's right. It's another, in a sense, unlikely match. And it's quite a literary poem, this one, on the page. I had to look up a word, actually, in this poem. That's how literary it is. Interpunctions. I'd never come across that word before. It means the placing of punctuation for anybody who is similarly curious. But maybe you could say something, Nicole, about the way in which, in a sense, the literariness has been replaced by lyricism here.
Listening back, I was just thinking about how Leah has chosen instrumentation to really paint the picture of the poem, like listening to the piano part in that track, how you can hear the leaves swaying, and I'm getting, you know, visions of country. It's really, really beautiful.
It is, yes. And the way in which the rhythm of the poem is lifted off the page and becomes the sort of skeleton of the song.
I was also just thinking, like, what just really struck me then, what a challenge it is to be given the lyrics before you write the song, the melody, having to respond and structure it around that. And I think it would have been a very different song as opposed to writing the music and then the lyrics. Having to write music directly in response to someone else's lyrics and what Leah's done there, some of the beautiful phrasing choices too, just, yeah, it's so good.
I think, though, that having the poem helps you create the sound world. You know, you have something there to work with, to start the process. You know, sometimes it's like when you get a new notebook and there's an empty page and, you know, there's a lot of pressure on you to fill the page with something to start from scratch.
Yes, yes. Well, listen, thank you very much indeed for having had this idea, and we're going to do it all again next year.
We are. Thank you to Radio National and the music show team for backing this. We've enjoyed it so much. And yes, it is back for Poetry Month across August 2026.
Okay. People can start scratching away now then, can't they?
Scribbling away now. Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Do people get pens out still? Maybe. Just don't go near AI. That's the only advice. That's the only
thing. That will not work.
It does not understand poetry.
Nicole Smead, David Stavanger, thank you very much indeed for joining me on today's music show.
Thank you, Andy.
Thanks, Andy.
Reed and Oak and The Arbor are available now via the ABC Listen app and also on the music show's website. If you're enjoying hearing a bit more poetry on the network, Line Break is at 12:45 on Wednesdays. New Australian poetry every week here on Radio National. And thanks to Red Room Poetry, our comrades in our crusade against the prosaic. I'm Andrew Ford. You're with The Music Show on ABC Radio National. To mark 250 years of Jane Austen, our friends at The Book Show are currently running a series called Dear Jane, about Austen's life, her books and her legacy. Gillian Dooley is the author of She Played and Sang, a book that looks at what characters such as Elizabeth Bennet and the Dashwoods were playing in their parlours, but also Jane Austen herself. I spoke to Gillian about that musical world on The Music Show last year. Gillian Dooley, welcome to The Music Show.
Thank you very much.
You tell us in this book, She Played and Sang, that Jane Austen copied out songs. And I wonder whether this was the Regency equivalent of making playlists.
Possibly, yes. She also had some printed music, so she would have either been given that or spent money on buying it. But music was pretty expensive, as was anything printed in those days. So if you wanted some music to play yourself later on, if you liked the sound of a song or you wanted to share a song with someone, you'd copy it into your manuscript book.
So what sorts of things did Jane Austen copy?
All sorts of things, really. There are also piano pieces. There is one complete Haydn piano sonata, for example. There are themes and variations for piano. There are a few dances. I know I've done a sort of statistical analysis of it somewhere in the book, but I did kind of work it out that there's something like, I don't know, 60% of it is songs measured by pieces of music. There are a lot of theatre songs, either opera or songs from the London theatrical stage. There are a few French songs, some theatrical and some more just romances. There's very few Italian songs, but mainly English songs, a lot of what one might call folk songs.
And do you think she made an enormous distinction between copying out, say, a Haydn piano sonata and songs, ballads by the likes of Charles Dibdin? Was it all the same to her? Because now we would look at one and say, oh, that's classical music, and we'd look at the other and say, well, these are just parlour songs.
I don't know that that kind of demarcation was current then. There was still a lot of divisions in the musical world. There were divisions between, well, foreign music and English music, for example, which was quite a current debate. But music that she was interested in having in her collection and presumably in performing crossed folk song and parlour song, I suppose. Sometimes the Dibdin things seemed a little bit unsuitable for the normal polite parlour. And some of the folk songs too, some of the Scottish folk songs are quite extraordinary in their directness. I think she just enjoyed music of all kinds, and she wasn't trying to impress anyone with music, I don't think. She just picked up what she liked and did that, because she would never play in company, apparently, her nieces said, which means, you know, she'd play within the family, but if there were people outside the family circle there, she wouldn't play in their presence.
Why does this matter? Why do we mind what kind of music she listened to, or the fact that she, you know, listened to and played music at all? How does it reflect on the novels, which I guess are the important things?
Yes. Well, I mean, to me, I think it's interesting to know that she played and sang, and the particular music that she played and sang is interesting. I mean, this subset, of course, which is what remains of the music books. I mean, for one thing, it gives us the ideas for what Elizabeth Bennet was playing and singing, for what Emma Woodhouse was playing when she was playing the little things which are normally, you know, thought appropriate. And what Jane Fairfax might have been showing off by singing. So it gives us a bit of a reality check about what they were actually playing. And they weren't probably singing Mozart, or they might have been singing some Haydn, but they were probably more likely to be singing Paisiello. James Hook or Samuel Webb or, you know, something like that. Also, I think, you know, understanding that Austen was a musician, to me, is reflected in the way she writes, because to me she's an amazingly musical writer. Her phrasing, the rhetoric of her writing has a musical flow to it. And I can see that sort of following over from being a singer and being a pianist as well.
Yes, she lands certain words, doesn't she? There's a kind of weighted quality to her writing, rather like a piano player.
Yes, yes.
She lived through the Napoleonic Wars.
Yes.
She died 2 years after the Battle of Waterloo. What do her musical tastes tell us about her attitudes to France and the war?
Well, they make it clear that she was absolutely aware of everything that was going on. Some critics in the past have sort of said, well, she didn't even bother to look across the channel to see what was happening. But she knew perfectly well. I mean, she had a cousin whose husband was executed in the terror in the 1790s. But she had music, she had the Marseillaise in her collection, for example. You know, she wrote the Marseillaise out in her manuscript book with all the verses, all those bloodthirsty verses in French. She also wrote out an anti-revolutionary ballad called the Chanson Béarnaise about how dreadful it was that Louis was imprisoned in France. She had the lament of Marie-Antoinette in a beautiful ballad called Captivity by Stephen Storrs. So, you know, these themes were very much implicit in her music collection. You could hardly not know. She had two brothers in the Navy. She was perfectly aware of what was happening. It was a matter of choice what she decided to write about.
Let's look at some of the novels and some of the specific instances of music in the novels. In Pride and Prejudice, there are these typical Austen scenes of parties where some young lady is at the piano, sometimes singing, sometimes just playing. And there's the lovely barbed comment of Mr. Bennet to his daughter Mary that you have delighted us long enough, let the other young ladies have time to exhibit, because Mary's not really very good, but enthusiastic. Mm. That moment always seems to sort of really take you to the heart of one of these soirees.
Yes, it's interesting because she actually, the narrator of Pride and Prejudice says that Elizabeth, though not playing half so well as Mary, was listened to with much more pleasure. So I wonder, what does it mean that Mary was playing well? If playing well is music that gives you more pleasure, what does playing well actually mean? Does it mean that Mary was not playing wrong notes and Elizabeth was sort of a bit more slapdash but had more sort of expression and spirit? I don't know. Another thing is that often in the novels I've noticed that she just says that she was playing. She often doesn't use the word singing, and it took me a while for it to twig that she was a singer. When she said playing, it often included singing. So the fact that Jane Austen herself was a singer was, for me, a sort of, 20 years ago, but it was a sort of revelation. I hadn't really thought of it before.
It's important, isn't it, that music is an amateur pursuit.
Yes.
In these novels. In Emma, we witnessed Jane Fairfax's distress at the prospect of her possibly having to use her musical talent to earn money as a teacher.
That's right, yes. Yes, it's poor Jane, you know, the governess trade she's destined for, and she's terribly unhappy about it. But she's saved, of course, by marriage to a questionable young man who... Not sure that that's a fate worse than death or not, but it is very interesting that thought that Jane Fairfax would be a governess is, to Jane Fairfax at least, such a terrible thought. But actually, even in Emma, there's a comment, Mr. Woodhouse, Emma's father, says, you know, but you realise that, of course, she will be to a new family what Miss Taylor, Emma's governess, had been to her. Through the voice of Mr. Woodhouse, the sort of ineffectual old valetudinarian, she makes that point that governesses aren't, you know, all miserable, suffering people and can end up having quite happy lives. You know, she always has this way of putting in the sort of other point of view somehow.
There's also, in the course of the novels, as the later novels, we witness a change in fashion when it comes to amateur music making in the home, because the harp becomes important. And still in Emma, Mrs. Elton laments the fact that Jane Fairfax has no knowledge of the harp.
Yes.
And the harp is more and more important as these novels go on.
That's right. Yes, yes. The harp becomes... Well, the harps were much more expensive than pianos in those days. And so most middle-class families could afford a piano. And, you know, the Austens themselves... Jane Austen herself, most of her life she had a piano. She spent her money on that, but harps were three or four times as expensive to get a modern harp, the sort of harp that Mary Crawford in Mansfield Park has, for example. That's a definite signal of her wealth and sophistication.
Gillian Dooley, and you can find the book show's Dear Jane series on the ABC Listen app now. The music show's produced by C. Benedict and Ellie Parnell. Technical production by Tim Jenkins. They're on Gadigal land. I'm on Gundungurra land. Coming up on the music show, Ariel Bart, the woman of 100 harmonicas, and Tony Wellington trying to summarise the entire 1980s in one episode. We'll finish today remembering Guy Gauss, best known for his 15-year musical partnership with balladong woman Gina Williams. He died last week at the age of 56. Guy and Gina were best friends, husband and wife, musical collaborators, and they put out four albums together, as well as two operas and two books. Their music blends music and guitar by Guy, lyrics and vocals by Gina in the Noongar language. Let's listen to a little of the conversation I had with them in 2021. This is Guy talking about how the collaboration worked and how the songs were written.
Every song has a backstory, so it's informed by four principles, which are
court, which is
your heart.
Then there's mort, which is
family.
And then burja.
Land.
And then Korlanga.
Which is children and how it relates to legacy.
Yeah, so everything that we do is informed by those things. And my uncle Tom Hayden, who's a balladong elder, he says if you have those four things worked out, then everything else falls into place. And so that, you know, everything that we do is guided by those principles.
So when Gina sings, it's extremely informed and musical. So the blank audio canvas is so easy to compose for. It's almost as if it's already done. I have a very easy job to colour and to make sure that it's it serves the language and serves the message.
And the other, it works both ways. Guy sometimes will play something and I'll think, oh, I know what that sounds like. So Bindi Bindi, for example, Guy sent that track to me from Europe. He was away at the time and I listened to the music and immediately thought of a butterfly. So that, you know, songs are kind of, we're very lucky in that we have a creative partnership that just works like that.
Bindi, bindi, bal, you are winyan, bal kanyin, mort it's good. Bindi, bindi, bal, jervin, bal, you are kurdak, not you are bal. Bindi, bindi, bal,
Call you cool. You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.